Thank you. I'm very honored to be here today to give this talk, and I would like to thank the organizers and especially Jason for inviting me. So the main questions that I'm interested in is, how is linguistic meaning related to perception, and I'm assuming it is, and how do we learn and agree on the shared meanings of our words and expressions? And the goal of this sort of big project is to provide a formal semantic and pragmatic account addressing these questions. So I will present a formal semantic approach to perceptual aspects of meaning, trying to show how you can actually incorporate that into formal semantics, and also showing how you can update perceptual aspects of meaning as a result of observing language use in interaction. So this enables accounting for fine-grained semantic plasticity and semantic coordination, and I will explain what those words mean. And I will also try to say something about compositionality and vagueness, and possibly also something about the relation to possible world semantics. So first, semantic coordination. So research in mainly in psycholinguistics on alignment shows that agents actually negotiate domain specific sort of micro languages for the purposes of discussing the particular domain at hand. So this is sort of in contrast to a view of language as static and given. It's actually being continually negotiated. Two agents don't have to share exactly the same linguistic resources in order to be able to communicate. They can sort of adapt as they talk, and an agent's linguistic resources can change during the course of a dialogue when she's confronted with an innovative use. So semantic coordination is the process of interactively coordinating on the meanings of linguistic expressions. So how does this work together with perception? Because perception is sort of inherently agent-specific. So there is no notion of objective perception. There is also always an agent perceiving. So if we are to include perception in our semantics, we need to somehow explain how individual perception relates to public meaning. And the key to this is semantic coordination. So by interacting with each other, agents reciprocally, back and forth, learn from each other and come to have more or less coordinated or shared takes on the words, on the world and on language. So, and this interactive coordination and reciprocal learning require what we call semantic plasticity, which is the ability of meanings to change. So one requirement on our semantics is that it enables the kinds of modifications that we need to account for coordination of perceptual meanings. Some of the mechanisms for semantic coordination in dialogue are corrective feedback, so where one speaker implicitly corrects the way an expression is used by another speaker. An example is adult and child at the zoo. The kid says, "That's a nice bear." The adult says, "Yes, it's a nice panda." So, and then the child can learn that that's this thing, which is black and white instead of brown, is maybe a panda. You can also have explicit definitions and negotiations of meaning, although this is not so common with perceptual language because those words are really hard to make explicit, like a color term. How do you define that in words? And another mechanism is just sort of silent coordination, where a speaker observes the language use of another speaker and just adapts to it without leaving any traces in the interaction necessarily. So to make this concrete, we have just to illustrate how this works in a very simple way, I'm going to use this left or right game to sort of amplify the interaction aspect. So we have two agents, A and B, facing a framed surface on a wall. A has a bag of objects that can attach to a framed surface. And the round of the game plays out as follows. So first, A places an object on the frame. B sort of, okay, zooms in on that object. A says left or right, meaning basically this thing is to the left or it's to the right. B interprets this utterance based on B's take of on the situation. And if B's interpretation of A's utterance is consistent with B's take on the situation, basically if A says it's to the right when B sees that it is to the right. then B will just say, okay, uh-huh. Well, no, then we'll say, okay, but if it's not consistent, so this is unexpected. A actually said to the left when B thought it was to the right. Then B will say, aha, someone's surprised, okay. Possibly a bit silly, but it's just a very simple setup. This left to right game can be regarded as a sort of pared down version of the guessing game in a paper by Luc Steels and Belpimi in 2005, where perceptually grounded color terms are learned from interaction between two robots, basically, robot heads. And I mean, the kind of meanings you learn in this left to right game are sort of trivial, but I'm just trying to make it as simple as possible, just to illustrate, just as an illustration of the basic principles, not to add too much complication. Color terms are really complicated. Positions are much simpler. But the hope is that this can be formulated in a general way that you can use in more interesting settings later. Okay, so now I'm going to talk a bit about symbol grounding and perceptual meaning. I'm not sure if this disagrees with what David said yesterday. Perhaps it does. It at least emphasizes differently. So I would say that if a speaker of English is unable to distinguish mittens from gloves, for example, most people, I think, would agree that something is missing in this person's knowledge of the meaning of glove and mitten. Similarly, if we tell an agent A to find some nice pictures of dogs chasing cats and they came back with pictures displaying lions chasing zebras, we would think that maybe they don't quite know what dog and cat means. So we take it that part of learning a language is learning to identify individuals and situations that are sort of in the extension of the phrases and sentences of the language. And for many concrete expressions, not all expressions of the language, many concrete expressions, this identification relies crucially on the ability to, one, perceive the world, and two, use this perceptual information to classify individuals and situations as falling under a given linguistic description or not. And a pioneer here was, of course, Harnad in 1990, who formulated the symbol grounding problem. So how can the meanings of the meaningless symbol tokens, manipulated solely on the basis of their arbitrary shapes, be grounded in anything but other meaningless symbols? So I actually also proposed a solution to this problem, or he sketched it. So his sketch had a hybrid system which encompasses both what he called symbolic and non-symbolic or sub-symbolic representations, where the sub-symbolic are such that they can pick out the objects to which they refer via connectionist networks. So this was in the 90s, that was all the rage, that extract the invariant features of their analog sensory projections without going, I'm not going into his specific terminology here, but. So, okay, so that's one bit. You need the both the symbolic and the sub-symbolic. And then learning these sub-symbolic or non-symbolic representations from interaction. So a connectionist network that learns to identify icons correctly from the sample of confusable alternatives it has encountered by dynamically adjusting the weights of the features. So that's the learning bit. And then you also need compositionality, where complex constructions will inherit the intrinsic grounding of what he calls the grounded set of elementary symbols. So it has this terminology that I'm not going into, but so you need a hybrid system, you need learning, you need compositionality to solve the grounding problem according to Harnad. So we can basically see what I'm doing here as an attempt to do this. And he proposed to use connectionist networks, but I mean, they're just one kind of classifier. Generally, why not use all kinds of classifiers? Where a classifier is, of course, a computational device determining what class an item belongs to based on various properties of the items. So crucially, for a statistical classifier, these properties don't have to be encoded in a high-level representation language, such as logic or natural language. They could just be numeric data, some kind of sensory input, low-level information about something in the world. Classifiers can be defined formally as functions or programs, if you like. And typically, the domain of a classifier is numerical. like for example a vector, and the range is a set of categories. So when we use classifiers in formal semantics, we'll think of them as parts of the representations of an agent's take on the intention of a linguistic expression. Intention with an S. Classifiers as intentions produce judgments as to whether some perceived thing or situation falls within the extension of a linguistic expression. Okay. So perceptual meaning is just a term to refer to an important aspect of the meaning of linguistic expressions, referring to physical objects. Knowing the perceptual meaning of an expression allows an agent to identify perceived objects and situations as falling under the meaning of the expression. For example, if you know the meaning of blue, you can identify blue objects and tell them from green, blue, red or yellow objects. Also for situations, if you're able to compute the perceptual meaning of a boy hugs a dog, you will be able to say, this is a situation where a boy hugs a dog and this isn't. So the idea of using classifiers to represent perceptual meanings comes from, Harnad originally, but he doesn't talk about classifiers, but it sort of seems to be going that direction. It doesn't use that terminology. I read about this first in this paper by Stiles and Belpimi that I mentioned, and they have talk about color terms. They have neural networks with weight vectors that are updated based on this interaction. So what I'm doing here can be seen as a specification or implementation of Harnad's ideas, adding interaction into the mix, following Stiles and Belpimi and representing takes on meanings as classifiers and training them based on dialogue interaction, but adding the connection to formal semantics, as well as an account of compositionality that, as far as I'm aware of, I haven't seen that before. So now let's get started on the formal semantics for perceptual meaning. So we want to integrate perceptual meanings and low-level perceptual data into formal semantics. So we need a hybrid system of the kind that Harnad talks about. To enable learning and coordination, we also need a framework where intentions are represented independently from extensions so that we can update them. And they need to be structured objects to enable these updates. And we also want to use a framework which encompasses accounts of many of the problems traditionally studied in formal semantics. So we don't want to throw out 40, 50 years of progress. But fortunately, a lot of these problems have been treated in type theory with records, TTR, that Shalom talked about the other day. Oh, thank you. So as many other type theories, TTR is based on the notion of a judgment of some entity being of some type. For example, a judgment that a certain situation is of a certain type. So TTR starts from the idea that information and meaning is founded on our ability to perceive and classify the world. So to perceive objects and situations as being of types. And this is why this is a very good theory to use when you're doing perceptual meanings. It's also well suited to this problem because types are first class objects, so we can formalize these perceptual classifier functions. It integrates logical techniques such as binding and lambda calculus into feature structure-like objects called record types. So you get more structure than in traditional formal semantics and more logic than in traditional unification-based systems. These feature structure-like properties are important for straightforwardly defining and modifying meanings in terms of refinement and generalization. And the logical aspects are important for relating our semantics to the model theoretic and proof theoretic traditions and compositional semantics. So I don't want to spend too much time going through the details of TTR. I just want to give you enough to follow the talk. So I'm going to zip through these slides, and then if you want to ask something about it, we can go back to it. Okay. So this A colon T means that A is of type T. In TTR, there are basic types. One is int, the type of an individual. Another is real, the type of real number. If you have two basic types, T1 and T2, T1 arrow T2 is a function type whose domain is objects of type T1 and whose range is objects of type T2. We have records and record types, and just quickly, this is a record. You have labels here, and you have values of the labels. And that record is of this type. And here you have the same labels, and you have types here. So this record will be of this type, given that this object is of this type, this object is of this type, etc. So here's an example. So the record to the left is of the type to the right, given that this object 1 to 3 is of type int, and so on. So also have these types with predicates, and you have an argument here. And this actually refers to this label up here. So this is a dependent type. As you see, the types can also be constructed from predicates. So this is the predicate man. So you can construct a type, man, ref, which is called a p-type in TTR, roughly corresponding to propositions in first-order logic. What objects are of p-types? Well, proofs. So this is the type theoretic intuition that propositions are types of proofs. So whatever counts as proof of a p-type can be an object of that type. If you have a record R with the label L, then R.L points to the object, which is the value of that label in the record, and the same thing for types. You can also have nested records and record types. And there's something called manifest fields, which looks like a mix between record and record type. So you have here a type, but then you're saying C-man has its value, which is of this type. And this is actually just a convenient representation for a type, so-called a singleton type. It's a type which only has one object. So this really means this, and this is the type that only has this object being of that type. Okay. That was the extremely quick introduction to TTR, and we can go back to this later. Okay, so now, how do we use this to model perceptual meaning? And I'm going to use the word right in the left to right game. So in the left to right game, it means something like the object that you're looking at is to the right, if you would translate it to English. It doesn't necessarily mean the same thing in that language game as in English. So, and the classifier we're going to use is a perceptron, because it's just the simplest classifier I could think of. When I did this, then I realized it is actually a simpler classifier than that. This has two dimensions. You could have just one dimension. But we'll get back to that. So, classification of perceptual input is a mapping of sensor readings corresponding to situations to types. And the perceptron is a very simple neuron-like object with several inputs and one output. We weigh together the inputs, and if they exceed a threshold, then you give one as output. It's a very limited classifier. It's constrained to just linearly separable learning problems, but fortunately, left to right is such a problem, that distinction. Okay, so we have this square surface, and we're placing objects on it. So to classify an object as being to the right or not, you direct the sensor, for example, a camera if you have a robot, or your eyes if you're a person, to the surface. You get a sensor reading, maybe a picture from the camera. You need to transform that into some slightly high-level representation, for example, the position of an object in that frame, still, though, a numerical value. So that's the dot. That's our object. So we've now seen it. And then we apply the perceptron classifier, which separates this area into left and right. Okay. So the classifier for right is going to say, one as output. It's to the right. Whereas if you place it here, it's going to say zero. So we can do this in TTR, actually. We can have a classifier formulated as a record with the weight and the threshold, so two weights, one for each coordinate, and then a function that takes a real-valued vector and outputs 1 if the weighted input exceeds the threshold, otherwise 0. So this function, kappa dot f, will evaluate to this function that takes this vector and this output. And now, since you see this v and w here, w is referring to this weight, so it's a dependent type, and v is the argument. So, yeah. And you can also actually train this classifier by modifying kappa dot w and kappa dot t, the weights and the threshold. There's one problem here. The basic perceptron just gives us 1 or 0. We actually want a p-type out saying whether this object is to the right or not. Generally, you can have a TTR classifier that outputs some p-type p or not p if it doesn't. If the weighted input doesn't exceed the threshold. Using this, we can formulate the meaning of the term right in the game. So the main point here is that we're mixing this low-level stuff, vectors for weights, with sort of high-level representations. So this is an interpretation function that has certain... So you're presupposing, you need to apply this to some situation where you have a sensor, so a position sensor reading, which is a real-valued vector. You have some focused object, foo, which is an individual, and you have some speaker. Actually, we don't use that here. So if you apply this function to a situation like that, you're looking at something, you have the position of it, it's going to output a judgment here, whether this situation is of the type that this object is to the right or if it's not to the right, without going into the details. But so we can see if we have a situation S, you have some coordinates of a certain object, 45 here. So this is our situation. It's a record. Here's our sensor reading. Here's our object. And then the speaker A says right, and then we apply this meaning to our situation. So this function S is of this type. So it's going to give us something like that. And what it gives us is this record type specifying that this, our take on the situation, is a proof of this object being to the right. So this is sort of a verification, a snapshot saying, this is how we know that object 45 is to the right. It's because we had the sensor reading when this object was in the focus of attention. Okay, so this is the TTR perceptron. Okay, so then we want to be able to learn these things from interaction. Of course, we can just use the perceptron training rule. This is straight out of, you know, standard stuff. So you have the target output and the actual output, and then you subtract those and multiply by sort of a learning rate number. This one there. Okay. And basically, we can formulate this as a TTR update function. It gets a bit hairy, so I'm not going into that here, but it's... So what this corresponds to... So let's say this is our initial take on the meaning of right, same thing I just showed you. So now we have a round of the game playing out like this. A says to the right. Okay, that's fine. It's to the right. Then A places an object here. So we can see that according to B's classifier for rightness, this is not to the right. It actually is to the left of the line. So that's a problem for B. What is B going to do? Well, you have to adjust the classifier. So you apply the perceptron training rule, and what you get out is now updated weights. So this is our updated representation of the meaning of right, and it corresponds to moving the line slightly to the left. So this happens, fortunately, now to be included in sort of the extension of the right. So B says, aha, I learned something. Okay. Of course, in this kind of game, there's an asymmetry between like a teacher and a learner. But we actually want to use this to model semantic coordination. We have like two agents that are equally proficient in that language, but still they might have slightly different meanings. So we want to model how they mutually adapt to each other. And you could easily modify this game to do that. You could just have them switch roles between each round. So then we'd actually get this convergence that they start out with, you know, different classifiers, but gradually they will converge to a shared meaning over a number of rounds of interaction. If I had implemented this stuff, I could have showed you nice graphs and stuff, but I haven't done that yet. So we take it that a central task of semantic theory is to model the semantic plasticity and semantic coordination. So by modeling how individuals represent meanings, use meanings to form judgments, and coordinate on meanings and judgments, we indirectly model how meanings emerge and perpetuate, and how you can have meaning variation in a linguistic community. At least we make that possible, that model. So although perception and mental representations concern individual agents, the meaning itself is actually here inherently social and dependent on learning and adaptation through interaction within the community. So if you believe this picture of language, it implies that a central task of semantic theory is to model semantic plasticity and coordination. So how meanings change as a result of language use and interaction, how you learn meanings. That's not a peripheral thing. It's like one of the central tasks of any semantic theory. Another central task is dealing with compositionality. So if we couldn't do compositionality with this account, that would be bad. So how can we extend compositionality to perceptual meaning? Well, first of all, to just keep within this very simple game, we need to add like some more words. So I'm just going to add upper and lower, and assume that we have some simple grammar allowing you to combine them into upper left, upper right, etc. This is only a sketch, very sketchy first steps, but just to give it an impression. So how can we compute the meaning of something like upper right from the meanings of upper and right? So we assume that we've seen the, how right is represented, and upper would be similar. So I just made some minor changes. I indexed these things with upper here. But this is the meaning of upper, and I sort of took out the classifier from this. So this is the same classifier as we saw before, but I just put it in as a function that you define outside the record. So basically, I mean, this is straightforward compositionality. You just merge the meanings. This operator is a merge. It just takes two record types or records and puts them together into one record type. It's fairly straightforward. I'm not defining it formally. But if you take, you're just going to see that you're going to have all the fields that are in either of the classifier record types, records. So what you end up with is two weights and two thresholds, and then it gets recursively merged. So we'll have a single background field. Actually, they are the same for both upper and right. And the function here will also merge these two. So we'll have one field here, upper, and one for right, and two classifiers as output. So just to make this simpler, the graphical representation is this. You have this is a classifier for upper, and this is one for right. So upper right is going to be this bit. Very straightforward. I'm not saying that, but that's what upper right necessarily means in English. It's probably a simplification. It's not necessarily as straightforwardly compositional as that, but just it's a simple example. A slightly more interesting example is degree modifiers. What if you say the far right? So what is the compositional semantics for a degree modifier like far? One proposal is that what it does is actually it takes a classifier and modifies it by changing the threshold. So far has some parameter, just a number. I'm not saying we would get that from or anything, but that has to be learned from interaction as well, somehow. It takes a meaning representation that defines the threshold and gives out the same meaning representation, and I'm not explaining this stuff, but with a new value of this threshold, which is the old one multiplied by this factor. Okay, so far right, you just apply this function to the meaning of right, and the threshold which was previously 0.09, is going to be multiplied by this alpha to yield this threshold. And what this means in a picture is that you're pushing the line to the right. So this is how we compositionally can put together an expression like far right from meanings of far and right in terms of perceptual classifiers. Okay, so I also want to say something about vagueness. I mean, I should say you are allowed to ask questions during the talk. Yes.
I like what you're doing with upper right and far right, but how do you know that with one of them you have the two separate things and with the other one you...
Yes. No, that's, I mentioned that's one of the future works. How do you know what kind of meaning to assign to any word? You're absolutely right. That's a big problem that needs to be solved, and I don't have much to say about it, unfortunately. I'm just trying to show that it can be done. If you solve that problem. Or if you sort of tell it in advance that, you know, if you build a dialogue system or something that should do this, you could cheat and just give it that. But of course, that would not be satisfactory from a like general theory.
Or you can have like several different frameworks. Where's the chair? For how you do it, and then and try all of them.
Yeah.
Do some sort of.
Yeah, that's sort of something like that. You sort of keep a record of how well they do, and you sort of, yeah. The one that does best, you apply that on it. There must be work like this done in machine learning, I assume. So I haven't looked into it. Yeah.
It does seem like it, I mean, given your overall perspective, that the challenge you should be posing yourself is how, given a bunch of like complex expressions like far right and far away and various things that can be modified by far that could be perceptually grounded, how do I learn an abstract meaning of far, which is a function on all of those meanings in an appropriate way? So
you're going
to need some sort of fairly complex hierarchical model, presumably, in order to do that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So. I haven't gotten to that yet.
Yeah. No,
anyone who has any ideas, I'm very happy for to get them. Okay, so I'm going to proceed. So, I mean, in this account, we're not doing anything about vagueness. Actually, I mean, being to the right is actually a vague concept. I mean, so it's not satisfactory. We don't want perceptual meanings to be categorical, because typically they're not. They're almost always vague, I would say. And many are also context-dependent, like Tall, of course. So this is based on a paper that's going to be presented at the STARS SEM in Dublin in August, so together with Raquel Fernandez. So for a case study, we use scalar predicates. That's the normal thing you do when you deal with vagueness. So interpreted with respect to scale, such one dimension, such as height, length, or cost. So this is one dimension. I had two dimensions before. And they have relatively simple semantics, and therefore it's a good example to use. But we actually want our account to work for n-dimensional concepts like shapes and colors, which is much more complicated. So there are many ways to account for vagueness. You can introduce perceptual uncertainty based on inaccurate or unreliable sense readings. So in line with Dan's work, we will opt for substituting this precise threshold with a noisy probabilistic threshold. So we consider the threshold to be a normal random variable represented by the parameters of its Gaussian distribution and the mean and the standard deviation. And exactly which function to use here, we just take that from a paper by Schmidt et al. Where they actually did an experiment and matched people's judgments about tallness to different ways of classifying this. So we can put this into TTR. So now we have parameters again. We have a constraint on the kind of context we can apply this function to. Now what we get out is a probabilistic Austinian proposition that I think maybe Shalom talked about the other day, or if you got to that. So it's basically just another way of coding a judgment. It's saying that this situation, R, is of this type with a certain probability. And in this case, the probability is given by a classifier for tallness, which takes these parameters defining the noisy threshold and also takes the situation that you're in and gives you the probability that an object X that you're looking at, which is of type C, so this is the comparison class, and they have a certain height. So here we assume that you actually know the precise height. I mean, really you would like the height to be in a probability distribution as well, maybe, because you have uncertain. So that's a simplification. So this classifier kappa here, we need to say something about what that is. So it takes as parameters mu and sigma for tall, and both of those actually are functions from a comparison class to the parameter. So this is one way of dealing with context dependence of terms. So that tall means different things for humans and basketball players and giraffes or whatever. And the output of the classifier is to just take this error function. So this is just from straightforwardly from noisy threshold classifiers. You have a threshold function. And here you use the height that you have in the situation. So R is going to be instantiated with your situation, this record. So R.h is the actual height of the person. Mu applied to R. So this is going to be the comparison class. So this is going to be mu for a human, and so on. And the error function gives you this gradients. And the output of the classifier corresponds to the probability that someone of a height h will exceed the normal random threshold with a certain mean and deviation. So, and then you can use this just to, so an example would be, let's assume we have mu as being 1.87 and sigma 0.5 for humans. So this is our noisy threshold. We have this guy, John Smith here, who is a human and his height is 188. We apply the function that we have, the meaning of tall, to this situation. And what we get out is this judgment saying that, well, this kind of situation where you have a human called John Smith of height 188, it's actually of the type where this guy is tall with a probability of 0.579 here, since that's what you get when you apply this classifier with these values to that situation. So, and then this probability you can use in further probabilistic reasoning to decide whether to refer to an individual as tall or to evaluate someone else's utterance describing that someone is tall. You could use it as a basis for describing this person in terms of being sort of tall, quite tall, very tall, extremely tall, etc. Of course, that would require that you say for each of these constructions, sort of, quite, very, and extremely, what the range of those are in terms of the degree of height. And you would need to learn that as well. Yeah?
Okay, cool question. Boundary is fine.
Yep.
The type of tall, this is for the lexing tall, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's simplified a lot, so it doesn't really work in that kind of setting. So it's just this. You would have to imagine some kind of tallness game. You sit and watch people, and you say tall, not tall.
Okay.
So you know, to make it work in like a full compositional, full blown way, it gets more complicated.
But in principle, it would work in both predicated case of John is tall, knowing what kind of thing John is, and
Yeah, that's going to take a bit more.
Yeah.
Just to follow up, it's the same notion of tall and located. In other words,
In that case, yeah. If they're of the same type, if they're both humans.
Well, tall is type index, but the point is that when you say tall man, you've explicitly used the type man.
Right, okay.
Now, if you say John is tall, John is both a man and a basketball player.
Okay, yes.
So how do you pick out the type for John? Which type of John? Because John may have many types at once, right? So how do you pick out which type is being used if tall is the same object in both cases?
Good question. Yeah. I don't know, but I'm just saying what you can do. If you know it, then you can use this. But I'm not solving that problem. But that's, it's a good question.
I'm just asking if TTR makes it easier for you in some way. I mean, I can imagine, for example, that in a particular representation of John, a principal type is chosen or something, which can be referred to when you predicate tallness of him.
Yeah.
I don't think that's the case, but I'm not sure. Shalom seems to want to answer.
No, we could set up
fictional procedures for computing medium tall man.
Right, but John is tall.
Yeah, it would work similarly as the generalized quantifier, John. And the level for generalized quantifier, I mean, it would be like Kim smiles.
Yeah, but I mean, we haven't an account of how you figure out which comparison class someone, if you don't, if it's not in the utterance, how can you tell? I mean, that's a good question, and I'm not sure TTR helps you with that, but it shouldn't make it impossible to give an account of that. Right. So, I mean, compositionality for these vague perceptual meanings and the interaction between compositionality and learning is really interesting because, I mean, if you only heard things like sort of tall, quite tall, very tall, I mean, to figure out the meaning of sort of, you would have to sort of isolate out over several occurrences with sort of tall, sort of happy, sort of hungry, and figure out, some shared meaning across all those. So this interaction between compositionality and learning is also one of the really hard problems here. So this noisy threshold, of course, can be learned. So I'm not sure how much to say about this. So basically, if you have, you keep keep a track of a lot of height observations, you can compute the noisy threshold based on that. And you can do that in various ways. And here also we follow this Schmidt et al., where they just asked people to make judgments, and then they tested different models. They discovered that the relative height by range model was one of the best. There was one other that was also equally good. It actually just takes into account the maximum and the minimum height. Yeah, it's not that interesting to go into the details, just to show that you can use some way of computing thresholds based on your observations. This makes it possible to learn the vague meanings. That will update the classifier in the similar way as we did with the write before. You will modify the noisy threshold. Okay, so now I want to try to connect this to the probabilistic TTR. So generally, we want classifiers for vague perceptual terms, which take a real-valued input derived from some sensory input and give these probabilistic judgments as outputs coded as probabilistic Austinian propositions. And then you can use those as input to further probabilistic reasoning. So we could imagine an agent having vague context-sensitive classifiers for shape and color, taking real-valued vector input, and then feed that into classifiers of objects of different shapes and colors, for example, fruits. So we'd have a fruits classifier that would specify perceptual meanings of words denoting fruits, but indirectly through shape and color. And all these classifiers would be updated as interaction proceeds. So, I mean, once you've taken the step from like a picture to a classification of the shape and the color, then you're basically in the sort of high-level representation. You say, it's this shape, it's this shape, it's this shape. You categorize the data already. So then you're into the realm of probabilistic reasoning. General probabilistic reasoning. And so the learning stuff in probabilistic TTR collected in one slide. So I'm not sure how much Shalom said about this, and I'm not sure how much I can say about it now, but it's all obvious, right? Well, I can say something. So we assume that an agent makes judgments and stores them as a finite string, this J. Oh, I should use this. Okay. So that's a string of judgments with probabilities that certain situations are certain types. And from this, you can compute the various parameters, the priors and the conditional probabilities that you need in a classifier. I mean, it's just Bayes' rule. So the probability of, so these are, so what you, so you have a classifier and you apply that to some situation, well, that's going to give you a set of probabilistic Ostinian propositions defining a probability distribution over the possible conclusions. So think of the possible conclusions here as different fruits. Situation types saying that in this situation you have an apple, in this situation you have a pear, etc. So those are the possible conclusions. You have evidence that's going to be like, it has this shape with this probability, it has this color with this probability. So you take the conditional probabilities of the for each t in the conclusions, given the evidence, multiplied by the prior of the evidence. This is the standard. So that's what you get out. So for each conclusion, you're going to get at the probability that that's the conclusion. So you get a probability distribution over possible conclusions. It's all falling out of the previous observations that you have in your store of judgments. And then you can add this judgment. So you have a sort of continuously growing string of probabilistic judgments. And the previous judgments are used to make new judgments. So like a loop. This is actually, if you read our paper from the EACL, we changed. This is now a much better learning theory. It's simpler and it's more general. I guess we will distribute the slides if anyone wants to have a closer look. And hopefully we'll have the full paper, longer paper, coming out soon. Okay. So putting this together with all the other semantic phenomena that are already modeled in TTR, we hope to be able to model things like, for example, an agent who's learned the meanings of tall, pear, far, and right can take a sentence like, most of the tall pears are to the far right. Okay, slightly weird sentence. And you can sort of show it different scenes and say, is it true of this, or to what degree is it true? How probable, you know. You can say, well, it's sort of true. But the idea is that, you know, this approach can be gradually extended to larger fragments of the language we use to refer to perceived situations. To something that can actually be useful. Okay. So I'll try to say something about classifiers in possible world semantics. So why are we not using possible world semantics? That's a question you get when you send papers into journals that publish semantic papers. So I had to address that question a bit and think about that. So this work builds on a conference paper a few years back where I tried to start making sense of this idea of using perceptual meanings models as classifiers and have that together with formal semantics in TTR. There has been some work recently where computational semanticists, often people also working with robots, connecting perceptual classifiers to compositional formal semantic representations in sort of possible worlds tradition. So one is Matuszek and another et al. And Krishnamurti in color. So it's sort of motivated by a practical problem of allowing robots to learn to connect language and the world. But they do it by using semantic theory, like similar representations as you would have in possible world semantics. So then the question is, can you do this using possible world semantics? So one reviewer pointed out that you can do this using Barker's account. Well, the reviewer thought so, at least. So Barker has an account of the meaning of tall. That might seem to provide a way of implementing classifiers in possible world semantics. I mean, then you don't have intentions represented explicitly. You just have characteristic functions, basically, right? So so I can say what how Barker did it. So he encodes information that some person, F, has height H in world W in form of the propositions, propositions of the form that E is tall to the degree F. F is tall to the degree E. So if you're, okay, so you think of degrees of height as just heights in meters. So a person who's has height 180 is going to be tall to degree 180, 179, 178, etc., all the way down. Or possibly 180, 179.9. I don't know how many decimals you want to, but okay. So given a threshold T for tallness, which is supplied by, so each possible world has a threshold, you can check that F is tall by just checking that F's height H, but you just check that if tall, if F is tall to degree T in this world. Yeah, so T is the threshold. So is F tall to that degree? So I have to encode in each world the degree to which each person is tall. Okay, so this is how he does it. So this is a method of implementing a simple threshold classifier extensionally by explicitly listing for each possible world all the degrees of Xness, where X is here tall, of an individual, yielding a positive output from the classifier. So that's one way of conceptualizing it. It's not what Barker does, but that's one sort of from our perspective here. Possibly you could make it made straightforward to just encode classifier functions extensionally, like the characteristic function of the classifier for all the inputs, this is the output. For all the possible inputs to this classifier, like for the right classifier for right, so for all the positions that are to the right, it's going to give true, and for the rest, it's going to give false. So this would make it seem, so maybe you can do this in possible worlds semantics. But I'm a bit, what I find a bit problematic is how do you generalize this to classifiers taking more than one input, complex classifiers made of neural networks, several interconnected layers of artificial neurons. It's going to be, the main problem is going to be the learning, because you don't have any parameters. You just have this input goes to this output. So how do you train it? Barker trains it by just taking out possible worlds. But, well, I don't know. For me, it's hard to figure out how you would do it. It's very, maybe someone will pick that up and try to do it. So I'm not sure. Also, compositionality, where you have, which I model here as modifying a threshold. So any situation we want to modify a threshold, if you don't have the threshold explicitly represented, you just have an extensional mapping from inputs to outputs, it's hard for me to see how you could do the learning without getting a very complicated system. But whereas our account of compositionality and of learning relies on parameters being explicitly represented and available for modification. Barker seems to want to stick to what you could call universal extensionality. So a world contains all the true propositions, you know, in the world. If you look at these guys doing this for robotics using something like possible worlds, they're actually just the possible world is actually just describing one situation where you have certain observations. It's not trying to describe the whole world. Of course, that would be not very useful for a robot that's just perceiving a situation. So they're sort of doing that and looking at, so using possible worlds to represent situations, which takes it a bit closer to the kind of account we have here, where you classify situations. So then, so one interesting question is how to account for the continuity of meaning in such an approach. So where the extension of a word may shift from one situation to another, right? So what remains the same from one situation to another if all you have in each situation is the extension of a predicate, you know, in that situation. One answer is to try to include representations of intention such as classifiers. And if these classifiers are to be taking part of the semantic theory, then you have a problem because of extensionality of possible world semantics. But if you develop it into sort of, you allow intentions to be explicitly represented and you look at situations instead of worlds, that could work, but then you're sort of going in the direction that we're in with TTR. You could also choose to leave out the classifiers and just say, whatever comes out of the classifiers, we use that to build our model of the world. We don't represent the classifiers. They're sort of outside of semantic theory. You can say it's low-level stuff. We don't care about that. The problem then is that you're not accounting for some of the aspects of meaning that we argue is quite central, namely learning and coordinating on perceptual meanings. You're saying, say, so that's not part of semantics. So this leads to an idea of that what we want out of semantic theory, we want to account for learning in individual agents, and this requires relativizing interpretation processes to individual agents. We think that intentions as linguistics of linguistic expressions modeled as classifiers should be treated as first-class objects, allowing semantic learning to be formulated in terms of modifying these structured representations. So we think that in the end, a type theoretical approach with structured representations, such as the one I presented here, will have some significant advantages over a purely extensional approach when it comes to including perceptual classifiers in formal semantics. Okay, so I presented a formal semantics for coordinating and learning perceptual meanings, combining a couple of different ideas. So perceptual meanings as classifiers of perceptual information, that's like the main thing. And then updating these based on language use and interaction, that's the coordination bit. And then also a bit about how you can do compositionality for perceptual meanings and how vagueness of these classifiers for vague perceptual meanings interact with probabilistic reasoning. Future work, there's a lot of that. So we already mentioned some of it. One is connecting low-level transformations on perceptual data. Now I just sort of waved my hand and said, you have a picture and somehow you extract the position. Of course, you know, there are the vision community has lots of ways of doing stuff like that, and we want to plug that in here. We want to extend the probabilistic learning theory to full Bayesian nets. Now it's sort of halfway Bayesian nets. We want to be able to learn the structure of probabilistic dependencies in Bayesian nets, not just have them given to us, but to actually learn them from interaction. We want to put together various kinds of classifiers like neural nets, noisy thresholds, k-nearest neighbor, what have you, because each classification problem has its own optimal solution, optimal kind of classifier, and also the associated learning methods for each of these different kinds of classifiers. And learning which kind of classifier to connect to a word is one of the big challenges, as Martha pointed out. And we want to explore the interaction between compositionality and learning that I also mentioned. The stuff I said here about the interaction and how that relates to the updates is really impoverished. We actually have a little bit more stuff worked out on corrective feedback and so on that I didn't talk about, but it's still, there's a lot of work to do in sort of connection between the pragmatics and the interaction protocols and the semantic learning. We also want to implement this stuff, verify these models in terms of how they behave in interactions. We can actually, build a dialogue system that does something like what I said and hopefully more interesting things also. Yeah, that's what I had to say. Thanks for listening.
Right. Well, it's noon, but let's take a few questions. All right. So I have a question. As I understand it, you have a distinction between phrases whose meaning is obtained compositionally and phrases, typically words, whose meaning is attached to a classifier or to a function on classifiers or something like that.
Yeah, I mean lexical items.
Yeah, exactly. But I wonder if that distinction is completely sharp. This really has to do with learning. So this is just the standard comment about sort of leaky compositionality. This is not the best example, but I can't think of the best example. So a blueberry is not the same as a blueberry. being blue and being a berry is neither necessary nor sufficient for being a blueberry, but they're not unrelated. And so it seems like your learning should be biased by the fact that some phrases, compositional phrases, even when they stop being compositional and take on a meaning of their own, reflect the original meanings of their constituents.
That's a very good point. And this should have been on this list, actually. And it goes both ways. So, I mean, you would like to be able to learn from, so you know what blue means, you know what berry means. Somebody said blueberry, and sort of you should have some way of at least distinguish them from raspberries or something, just based on knowing their blueberries. But also kids, when they learn language, tend to go the other way. They have a big construction, and then they gradually realize it's actually different words. It's actually a compositional expression, you know. So you should be able to go both ways in the learning theory. Yeah, that's a good point.
So I'm intrigued by the comments about the relationship between this and, say, Barker's, which I take as, a microcosm of the dialectic between sort of formal semantics as it's standardly practiced in a Monegovian tradition and the TTR approach that you're pushing. So one of the points that you made was okay, you can probably make the semantics work if you rig it up more or less the way Barker does and maybe add some probabilities in like I did, kind of lightly on top of it. But then where does a learning theory come from? And I don't know, I mean, I got the feeling from it that what was at issue was whether you call learning part of semantics or not, basically whether you label it as part of the theory of semantics. And that doesn't seem to me to be a very deep issue. So Barker would just say, I'm not giving you a theory of learning. Of course, these things have to be learned. Everybody knows that. And if you give me a theory of learning, I'll just lay it on top of this theory of semantics, and that'll be a theory of how these things are learned. But is there something deeper at issue than,
I guess,
you know, if I had a theory that constructed a lot of candidate meanings and then, you know, evaluated them against evidence, say, in a language acquisition process and ended up with a meaning, you know, a meaning or a distribution over meanings that look like the ones that Barker is giving us, would that not count as a sufficient representation in learning theory?
Probably would. I just haven't seen one. So that, and for me, I can't, if I try to think of how, I can't sort of figure out the way to do
just
it.
You start off with some prior distribution over functions of the type that Barker is giving you, and then you evaluate them against evidence and acquisition, and then you end up with a posterior distribution,
right? Right. But I would like to see how it works out when you have not just like height. Height is like a one-dimensional. It's fairly simple. How complicated does it get when you move to a neural net with, 20 neurons with a couple of 5-10 weights each? You know, how complicated is that going to get? Is it something you want to work with? That's sort of that kind of question. So I'm not saying it's impossible. It's just that it seems very inconvenient to not represent thresholds and parameters for classifiers when you want to that's what you want to modify. I'm not saying it's impossible, but it seems like it's so much simpler if you can just modify them. You know, if you can just update the thresholds directly, it makes life so much easier for a learning theory. But yeah, I mean, I would love to see someone work. So I started thinking when I got these reactions, should I try to do this? But I'm not the right person to do that, right? So I would love to see it worked out.
So in the absence of ontological challenges to the existence of grounding at all, I guess we'll return for lunch, and I think we'll lead this more discussion this afternoon.
Okay.
Thank you.